Hour number two, Overdrive. Jim Taddy and Steve Simmons subbing for the regulars. Captain Hayes certainly deserving the holiday more than Noodles and O-Dog. I have to say, Hayes does a great job on this show, herding the cats.
You know, I'm out golfing as often as I can in the summertime. And so you're always running into people who may know your name or may know your face. And one of the first questions I get asked everywhere I go now is, what's Jeff O'Neill like? What's Jamie McLennan like? And how does Brian Hayes do what he does? And is Brian Hayes as great at doing his job as we think he is? And these are people who aren't in our industry. These are just guys who like to listen or like to watch on television or whatever. But, I mean, I was playing yesterday, and both of the guys I was playing with, all they wanted to know was about those three. And they're all Overdrive nuts like I am when I'm not here. You know, the pandemic has turned me into a... Between 4 and 7, like, nobody talks to me. I got my TV on.
And I think a lot of people say that. Then I've told the boys that the show will be around for 20 to 25 years if they want it to be. It's that good a show.
Yeah, and it's just a wonderful combination that somehow works. And sometimes you put people together, you have no idea how.
Much like the search for the left winger in the Leafs lines.
Yeah, you never know whether you're going to be the next star or the next Lonnie Bohannis.
A training camp phenom.
Well, Lonnie Bohannis had that one. It was a playoff, I think, with him. He had the real good playoff and a real good end of the season. Everyone, oh, Lonnie Bohannis, he's going to be something. He was something. He just wasn't something here.
Yeah, just not with the Leafs. You're going to be something. I don't know where, but you're going to be something.
You're going to be a contender.
Coming up shortly, Steve Phillips, our TSN MLB analyst, talking about the Jays. We'll get there eventually. Tony Sharp, Canadian Olympian, Andre DeGrasse's first coach, and you say he discovered him.
Yeah, my understanding is, and we'll get it better from Tony later on, but, you know, he was training runners, and all of a sudden Andre's sort of around there, and he had never done anything, you know, organized before, and I think he got him his first pair of cleats and said, you know, why don't you come out and work with us? And Tony was an Olympic runner for Canada, so he knew all about what this is and what this is about, and I believe he started him out. How much he had to do with the progression after that, we'll ask him, but I believe he was the first coach to sort of say, why don't you come out and hang with us?
And that's a classic Canadian story there, isn't it?
Well, I've heard
the Olympic star from the past. Here, try these on.
Well, yeah, and we've seen it with other sports. You know, have you ever played this before? You know, why don't you come and row with us? Or why don't you come and swim with us? Or why don't you come and do that? And a kid sitting there, and I don't know how old, I think he was like 12 maybe, or maybe a bit older than that. And all, you know, I remember that we heard same stories about other guys running in Toronto, that when there used to be far more clubs and more organized things than I think we see today.
Yeah, you wonder what the pandemic effect will be on some of that stuff, because a lot of it was closed, right?
Yeah, and there was a story that came out, I think about 2 weeks ago, which really upset me, about young ladies, young women who had been in sports before and were dropping out rapidly.
Yeah.
And I hope the Olympics rekindles everybody's enthusiasm for what sport can be and what sport. And I heard one of the Canadian beach volleyball players talking about, you know, how difficult it was losing. But she says if we got one person interested in ever playing this game again. It's not, I mean, how many kids are saying, Mom, I want to be a beach volleyball player?
By the way, on the Women's Initiative, Tennis Canada has a major initiative going to correct that.
Well, Tennis Canada is one of the few groups in this country that's had a phenomenal run of developing young athletes, and really both males and females. When you look at Denis Shapovalov and Felix on the men's side, and Bianca Andreescu on the women's side with Leyla Fernandez, there is a great group of young, and they all kind of came post Milos Raonic, and a long way post Daniel Nestor. But it takes a program to put these kind of guys in place, and the right coaches, and the right people, and how do you get them to the world stage, and how do you get them to the next, you know, what becomes local, then becomes provincial, then becomes national, and then international. It's a fascinating process to watch kids develop. I wish we had more programs in this country for kids across the board in so many sports. And a lot of the sports aren't sports that are expensive to play.
Yeah, so, it makes you wonder. Infrastructure again. At 6:05, we're going to have Randy Ambrosio and the CFL commissioner, CFL back. This has to be a logistical nightmare to get everything cranked up and going after a year off.
Do you know who had the worst job in Canada in the last 18 months?
CFL commissioner.
Yes. My friend Randy Ambrosio. I mean, it was dreadful. You're dealing with not just the pandemic. You're dealing with each province has different rules.
Right.
So there's a team in BC, there's teams in Alberta, there's a team in Manitoba, there's a team in Saskatchewan, there's a team in Quebec, there's a team in Ontario. Try juggling all that.
All the different health regulations.
It's madness to try. I mean, they're going to have their season, I hope, and I hope it comes off terrific, and you know, certainly Randy deserves it, and so do fans who love this game and want to be part of it. And so there's that, but boy, has this been a difficult thing, because you also have, almost half the players are American, if not more than half?
Yeah.
So you have half the players who have to come in, and then you have testing, and then you have all this other stuff. It's complicated.
And I guess the good news is, it opens up at a time when, there's gaps in the stadium, but you're not running tests like the Buffalo Bills had to do at the start of last NFL season, where they had to test people before they could allow them in.
Yeah, and they're now doing something too, though. And the NFL started this a couple of weeks ago, where they said that if your team tests positive with enough guys that you have to cancel a game, we're gonna credit you with a loss in the standings, and you're not gonna get paid for that week. So all of a sudden, NFL players are looking at their teammates. Get your shot. Get vaccinated.
Yeah,
that's a big locker room thing right now. Nobody wants to be that team that loses a game because of COVID and because someone didn't get their needles. And now I saw the CFL just put something in. I think it was yesterday or the day before. The same rules where they're going. If there's a game, and we'll get Randy to expound on this when he's on, but if there's a game that's called off for whatever reason, somebody's getting blamed for this. This is not just happening freely and happily.
It still boggles my mind that football has no guaranteed contracts.
Well, whoever started the NFL Players Association should be put in jail. Like what he did to that group and how the owners took over that circumstance, and they're never giving back.
No.
And every other league looks at the NFL and says, how did we get our contracts guaranteed?
Yeah.
And then you look at what, the Marvin Millers and the Don Fairs did in baseball, and other people did in Goodnow did in hockey, or even before Goodnow. And so you think to yourself, boy, the owners of NBA teams and NHL teams and baseball, well, they would love to have players on non-guaranteed contracts. Because guess what? You're hitting 180.
Bye.
Bye. Doesn't cost me anything.
Yeah, see ya.
Yeah.
Where are you playing tomorrow? Not here.
Well, and football has the ability. There are some guaranteed contracts in the NFL, but they are that's the Patrick Mahomes types who usually have their contract guaranteed. It's not you and me.
And it's fascinating to see the discrepancies when you do the four major pro sports and the movement that the NBA grants its players, and the dollar figure is stunning. But in the NHL, it's like everybody's counting everybody's pennies. Oh, you can't do that because it'll wreck the cap. And it's just the differences across the board are fascinating.
Did you see? I don't know if you saw this, but it. When I see a crazy number, it sticks with me. And I think about 3 weeks ago, the story came out that the NFL teams get $309 million a year from television money.
Right, yeah. Don't even have to have anybody there.
Yeah. That's before they've...
Yeah, sold a ticket.
Right?
Yeah.
And the salary cap is just over 150-ish million. I don't know exactly what it is, but... It's not anywhere close to what they have coming in. And here we are, and here's Randy Ambrosi trying to operate the CFL. And what are they getting from television? And it's a lot for Canada and what TSN's paying.
Yeah.
But it's not 300.
Don't do a comparable.
It's not 300 million U.S. a year.
Jays winning 7-2 last night, 4-1 on the welcome homestand. 7 games left against Cleveland again tonight. Matt's at 8-6 will go for Toronto. Joining us now on the Maple Toyota Hotline is Steve Phillips. Steve, welcome in, sir. How are you today?
Yeah, good morning. Good to be with you guys.
Our pleasure to have you. And just going back, and you probably said this with other people, but when you analyzed what the Jays did at the deadline, was this good for you?
Oh, yeah. It definitely was good for me. I mean, I'm sure I would have probably liked another starting pitcher, but I definitely think that they've impacted their game. And you know, especially in the bullpen, I think the Joaquin Soria addition late was a very good one for them. And in a veteran guy there into the pen and to go with Brad Hand. And now it's going to be up to the players to go out there and do their thing and get it done. I mean, I love how Alec Manoa came out of the gates and off the aisle and threw the ball really well. You know, it looks like George Springer's bat's really heating up. And they just have to pitch now. And if they pitch, they should be able to make this run. You know, I know the Yankees have played some good baseball lately as well. You know, Oakland's been a little bit hit and miss, but it's going to be a terrific race to the end.
So what a greedy guy you are. The Jays have Ryu. They've got Ray. They've got Manoa. Now they've got Berrios, and you want more starting pitching.
Yeah, I want more. Because you know what it is that there's nowhere to go now for additional depth. You know, when you don't have any place to go, then I want to make sure I have it in-house because they've experienced and they've test-driven all of the depth that they currently have and haven't found the answer. And so I would like to get somebody who, if somebody goes down or there's an injury, that you've got somebody that is more than just a player who's still figuring it out at the big league level. And so, you know, I saw Zach Davies hang in there and not get trades, and I thought, man, I'd love to have that guy. He throws strikes, and look, if he pitches, he gets up four runs in five or six innings every time, this Blue Jays team's got a chance to win. And so you don't need somebody who's perfect. Just give me somebody who's predictable.
So here's my concern as someone that really likes this Jays roster. My concern is with 58 or so games to go, that they've put themselves in such a difficult position with their one-loss record. Not that they can't get to a wild card race of sorts, but every time they win, one of the four teams that's between them and a playoff spot is bound to win. And so you're only picking up, you know, games, you know, in a very small way. And difficult when you have to make a large leap to get to where they need to go. So I'm wondering, do you think Ross Atkins took too long to take care of the Jays' pitching?
No. You know, I think that actually he did a better job of that than most. When you think about the fact that they got Trevor Richards and Adam Simber, you know, I think Simber back in Dickerson back the end of June, and then Richards even before the break. And so I don't, you know, it takes two to tango, and I don't know that teams were dancing until closer to the trade deadline. And so I don't think he could. I mean, I would have said last offseason I would have liked another starter. I think they didn't make the moves then. They were going to wait and see how it played out this year with some of the guys they did have. So, so thank God for Alec Manoa because he really wasn't part of the plan because Pearson was going to be the guy that was part of the plan. And they've heard flip-flopped, the short-term planning and development for the two of them. But I think as far as in-season, you know, it's really hard to get good pitching in the first couple of months of the season, even for the teams that are rebuilding. You know, they want to be able to sell some tickets, have some fans come out, give them something to watch, at least for some period of time. And so they want to have some competitive team. So I don't know that he could have done more than he did. I think that I would have loved more. Look, I love Barrios. I think he is terrific. It's a great pickup. He looked great in his first start. I mean, it was terrific. I think that it is a big hole. It's not too much to overcome, even with the teams that are involved. It's going to take maybe a run where they win 7 out of 8, 8 out of 9, and then they can go back to the alternating way of playing, right? They just have a little bit of a run. I like the Blue Jays better than the Yankees. I don't, you know, I know the Yankees added some bats. They didn't add any pitching. And they're waiting and hoping on Severino and Corey Kluber to come back in September. We have no idea what those guys are going to be. They could be good, but even if they're good in a game, I don't know that they're going to be consistently good coming back from Tommy John surgery and another injury. Oakland, I like. I think Oakland adding Starling Marte was big for them. You know, they fortified the bullpen a bit as well, and some of the roles on the team, I think they've done some things to make themselves better. But I worry more about, and I don't worry about Seattle. They're a house of cards that I believe. I know they believe in themselves, but I think at some point that's going to come tumbling down. So I think the bigger issue is Oakland for the Blue Jays. I mean, the Yankees are going to be close, but the Yankees aren't going to separate themselves from anybody with the moves that they made. I like the bats they got, but they can't pitch, and so that's their bigger issue.
Steve, I'm going to ask you to be a weather forecaster with much greater accuracy. Based on what you've said there and your projections with the run differential that we've talked about before, you know, how deep can the Jays go? Because we've had preliminary round disaster here in Toronto, and we want to know, like, can they make noise if they get into the wild card?
Well, anybody who gets in can make, you know, like Yankee fans love to say, well, just give us a chance in that wild card game. We've got Gerrit Cole. They don't know that. You may need Gerrit Cole to pitch on that Sunday before the wild card game on the last day of the season to even get to the wild card game. It's going to be such a great race till then. So anybody who thinks, well, we've got one great pitcher, so we have a good chance of winning a wild card game. I mean, you better hope that everything aligns perfectly and that you probably rolled the dice in the last couple games of the season and don't use that one pitcher and then get lucky to win and then hope that he's available. Because, you know, if they need him to pitch, he's going to probably pitch on short rest on the last day of the season or pitch on his in between starts on that day. So, so the Jays can do it. You know, they don't have the pitching the White Sox do or the Astros do, but it doesn't mean that they don't have good enough pitching. They're going to have to win some games in a bit of a different way, but they can advance if they get there, and even as a wild card, because I do like their pitching better than the Yankees' pitching. And you know, I think that if they win a wild card game, they could still throw a game one starter in the division series that I think is more than formidable in a competition like that.
Well, when I look at the American League East, and I've been watching it pretty closely all season long, I like the Jays' roster better than the Red Sox roster. I like the Jays' roster better than the Yankees' roster. And I know this is a terrible thing to say because we never really understand what the Tampa Bay Rays are, but I like their roster better than Tampa Bay's roster. And all season long, they've been sitting in fourth. Other than bullpen not working, why has this Jays team not been as good as three teams that they should be better than?
Yeah, timing is the issue. I mean, you look at the run differential, and it indicates that the Blue Jays are better than the Yankees and the Red Sox, but run differential doesn't, you know, we don't consider that in the standings. And so timing has been the issue. The Blue Jays win big and lose the close games. I think their record in one run games is not very good. Their record in extra inning games. And so, you know, you start looking at some of those close games and the way that the numbers are there, and you start to figure out within that where some of the difference is in the standing. I agree with the Red Sox, but, you know, there's a difference between having a pitching staff. You can have two pitching staffs, one that pitches to a 4.5 ERA, one that pitches to a 4.1 ERA, and in some ways the 4.5 ERA team can be better if the timing and the way that they pitch is more predictable. And so what I mean by it is, okay, 4.5 ERA is a quality start, so that's, you know, three runs and six innings. We give that a quality start, but 4.5 ERA doesn't sound great. But what happens is that when you have a team where to get to the 4.2 ERA, you get a shutout on one day, and then you get a starter that throws a clunker, giving up seven runs the next day, those don't equal the same as a guy that gives up three runs in six innings every day. It's a different game. And what it does is it changes the at-bats for your offense. It burns through your bullpen in a different way. And what ends up happening is that you overwork your bullpen in a way that, which is a lot what the Blue Jays did, and they had so many guys coming in and out that you end up fatiguing them to the point of overuse. And then you may have two games where you pitch great as a starter, but then you get three more clunkers and you burn through your bullpen again. And so timing really matters, and the Blue Jays' timing has not been good. Now, typically, over a season, the timing issues can resolve themselves and even out. The last time a team made the playoffs with a negative run differential is 2007. But we may see a team this year that might make the playoffs, or two that might make the playoffs with negative run differential. It just doesn't really often happen.
So as we're sitting here now in early August, you know what the schedules are like. What chances, in your mind, what chance do the Blue Jays have of being in that wild card game at the end of the season?
Yeah, so I think they've got a I think it's a pick'em between the Yankees, the Jays, and the A's. And I'd probably say 35% for the Jays, 35% for the A's, and 30% for the Yankees. That it's like that, it's gonna be that close to the end with those three teams fighting for the second wild card spot.
We'll hold you to it, Steve. Thanks very much.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Steve Phillips, TSN MLB analyst at Steve Phillips GM is the Twitter account. And Steve Phillips joined us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. It's time to Toyota right now. Drive in the new 2021 Corolla LE upgrade for the same price as the Corolla LE. MapleToyota.ca. So free upgrades, what we're trying to say there.
Perfect.
Yes.
If it takes 90 wins or right around there to get into the playoffs, and I think that's what it's going to take, somewhere between 90 and 92 wins. Do the Jays have enough time with 58 games to go?
Yeah, just looking at that.
To get to that number. Like, they're going to have to play six-something baseball the rest of the way. And they have a good schedule. They have an easier schedule than the teams that they're chasing.
Well, so let me ask you this. If they did, if they were able to play 600 baseball, you might be inspired that they could go deeper, right?
Well, if they can do that and get into a wild, and one thing that's interesting, you get into the wild card spot, normally you want one of your guys, one of your aces to be ready to pitch that wild card game if you're in the wild card game. But what the Jays have are you, they have Ray, they have Berrios, and they have Manoa. And I would be comfortable sitting here managing from this studio right now.
Which is the best place to manage from.
I would be comfortable having any one of those guys in a one-shot wild card game. I just think enough of all four of those starting pitchers that they could get through with that guy, with this lineup, and you're just starting to see what George Springer can do.
Yeah, so how would you compare this to what we've had in the past, 2015?
It's a different kind of team. I mean, 2015 was a veteran team of old guys that, you know, Josh Donaldson, you know, the MVP season, and Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion, and those kind of sluggers who had pedigree.
Yeah.
These are guys, I mean, these are kids that the other day were tying up Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the dugout on the day he wasn't playing to keep him, you know, still. I mean, this is a playful young group. And, you know, it's a group you can't help but like. I mean, it's a really likable team.
You'd have to go back decades to find that.
I think this reminds me of those sort of 84 Blue Jay teams when Mosby and Bell and Barfield were all sort of becoming something. And that's what, here you've got Guerrero and Bichette. And then you look at what Simeon and Springer have brought. And there's so many different portions and components that this roster has.
We'll get into that as we move along. Tony Sharp is next. This is Overdrive, streaming online, listening on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4. Jim Taddy, Steve Simmons, today, tomorrow, and Friday. Some sort of a book title there. Maybe not. Anyway, Tony Sharp will be by very shortly. Canadian Olympian, Andre Degrassi's first coach, and maybe discovered him. We'll figure out how that all started. But here's what I want to ask you while we're waiting for Tony to hook up: the 200 meter goal. Do you do lists? I'm not a list guy. I tend to appreciate things as they happen, and I don't like to do comparables. Do you do that? And where would you put this?
I always do it in my mind. I don't always, you know, write about it necessarily or put it in a column or even discuss it. But I always like to compartmentalize accomplishment. And when you've been doing this job, as long as we've been doing this job, you know, you've seen so much over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look at this medal, and to me, it's a giant accomplishment, the gold medal in the 200 meters. Sprinting is a world sport. It's a sport that every country participates in. And when you think of the giants who have done this over the years and got to this point, and then you think of Canadians that have, you know, attempted, and many of them have, to be successful at 200 meters, and really only one person has. And we had runners like Atlee Mahorn and other people over the years who were quality track and field people. But to have a gold medal and another medal at 200 meters from two different Olympics, that's breathtaking.
Well, and again, you know, how he won the race, how he accelerated, how he, I mean, just got better as the race went on. I mean, that's not always done. That's certainly a landmark moment.
Well, we've been used to a little bit in this country, over a very long period of time, 100-meter runners and right. What it takes to win at 100 meters. The 200's a different race. And so your start isn't nearly as prominent in a 200-meter race as it is in the 100. There's a little more strategy in the 200 meters. And what amazes me about André de Grasse is that from, I don't know whether it's 80 meters or whatever it is into the race, to the final 100 or the final 120 meters, he becomes the fastest runner in the world.
Right.
Like, and that's where the relay gets interesting for him also, because, you know, he's going to be in the 4x100, I presume, at this point, you know, health issues and other things obviously being involved. But when you can do that, and he's not built the way sprinters traditionally are built. He's not big. He's not bulky. He's very different, and to see the speed with which he runs, it really does take your breath away.
That would be a great question for Tony, is, you know, where does the power come from?
And people who were telling me this, technique-wise, if you watched him run in 2015 in Toronto in the Pan Am Games, and Tony Sharp was there, I believe, and then you watch him run now, you see growth. You see things, you know, his arms were all over the place in Rio. His arms were very controlled in running the 100 and the 200 here. He does look like he's somebody's little brother when you're standing at the start line with some of those guys
right.
alongside of him. And you think of Ben Johnson and that giant chest of his and the giant muscles from weightlifting. And you think of, you know, Donovan Bailey at 6'3" or whatever Donovan is. And you know, and built with those long, long legs, and André de Grasse again. Look, he looks like somebody's little brother.
And I know we said this, I think, off the top. It's just one of the fun things about what we do in our different disciplines is watching people start with promise, realize it, and then be rewarded with success.
I love that process.
Yeah.
And I don't care if it's watching Connor McDavid play as a 14-year-old in the GTHL and then seeing him play junior and then watching him in the NHL and then seeing him dominate completely. Or if it's, you know, a swimmer that you might have seen. Say you saw Summer McIntosh for the first time a year ago and she's 13 years old and suddenly she's qualifying for national events. And, you know, come the next Olympics, she's going to be 17. And we're going to get a chance to see what happens on that progression. And we've seen it in some sports. Like I'll use figure skating as an example, where a 15, 16, 17-year-old figure skater is suddenly at 20 not so prominent for whatever reason. And there's a great example of that in Toronto. Because a hockey scout who I know very, very well told me that at 18, Jack Campbell was the best teenage goaltender he'd ever seen. And then Jack Campbell went through almost 10 years of trying to find his place in the NHL.
He had a great World Junior, didn't he?
I think he had two or three World Juniors, if I'm not mistaken. But he was strong in all of them. And this, the scout who I know, who actually was part of the drafting of his in Dallas, is a former NHL goaltender. So it's not like
someone that is.
Who didn't know the position.
Yeah.
And he said at the time, I think it's before Carey Price or about the same time, that he was in that conversation.
He was well thought of when he was drafted, that's for sure.
And it took Los Angeles to rebuild him to get him to where, you know, the Leafs were able to sort of take advantage.
Well, that's always the interesting hockey transition is you've got this prospect and you have to change something about him to make him suitable to your roster. Not everybody completes that hurdle.
I was in Western Canada in the early 80s, my first job in the business, and there was a defenseman playing in the Western Hockey League named Jim Benning, who was as great a junior hockey... I mean, I didn't see Bobby Orr play junior. I don't have recollection. I remember Jim McKenney was supposed to be the next great somebody.
Right.
But Jim Benning controlled the game.
That's what Bobby did.
And he controlled every... And I'm talking in the Western Hockey League.
Yeah.
And then the Leafs drafted him, and it didn't work out.
Well,
he might have been too soon. He might have been rushed. He might have been 18. Whatever it was, he never got to be what so many people thought Jim Benning would be.
Three kids on the same blue line, yeah. All graduating and at the same time.
Nobody said when the Leafs drafted Jim Benning or when he was coming out of the Western Hockey League, that guy's going to be a GM one day. No, it was like the next this.
Well, you know, the Leaf team was bad, and they tried three kids in the blue line the same year, and Benning was one of them, and, I mean, that's a struggle.
Yeah, but sometimes, I'll use Chris Pronger as an example. Chris Pronger, in his first or second NHL season, was, this kid's a lot of trouble. This kid is a problem.
Well, I mean, he's a guy who had to grow into his body,
we're not
right?
sure he's going to be able to do.
Yeah.
By the end of his career, he's generational.
So Pronger, Lindros at that age was already a man in a man suit,
yeah.
and Chris Pronger had to grow into his suit.
It's funny because Eric got worse over time, and Pronger got better over time.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that.
I mean, you go through those dominant Lindros years where he was top three player in the NHL. You know, he was early 20s, mid-20s for some of that. You know, as he got older and more beaten up and more injured and more concussions and whatever else happened to him, you know, it was a sort of a law of diminishing returns kind of thing.
Just to stay back in where we are in the time frame, to watch Eric Lindros, to remember him as a junior was a little humorous because he was just so much bigger and physically mature than anybody on the ice.
I remember them in a Memorial Cup, the Oshawa Generals, or I think it was a Memorial Cup, and it looked like there was this one Paul Bunyan-like giant.
Yes.
And then there was everybody else. And he was bigger, and he was... It's like watching Jim Brown on those old NFL films.
Right.
And he looks bigger than the defensive lineman as he's running the ball, yeah. And he's faster than they are. And it's like, well,
because he was.
Yeah, I know. But you don't see that often in sport where one guy is just so physically dominant. That's what Eric was like that.
Yes, he was.
In junior hockey. I mean... I would have hated to be one of those kids playing for Peterborough or wherever else.
Well, yeah.
So, Oshawa's in tonight.
So Eric in his last year and somebody in their first year. Yeah. Kind of a mismatch.
Yeah, not good.
No, but anyway, that's the history lesson. So Tony's going to send his regrets, and we'll check out and come back and take you to the top of the hour. This is Overdrive, streaming online, listening on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4. Overdrive, TSN 1050, TSN 4, streaming online, Jim Taddy and Steve Simmons summing for Hayes, Noodles, and O-Dog. Tony Sharp will be with us in a couple of minutes. We can talk about DeGrasse's gold medal, 200 meters. Doesn't that sound great?
Well, especially, it's the first time, I believe, for Canada. You have to go back to Percy Williams.
That's right.
I think that's 1928. Percy Williams won the 100 and the 200. In I believe it was 28. And you think, well, is that 100 years ago? It's close to 100 years ago.
Feels like it.
Yeah. I wasn't, put it this way. It's so long ago, Jim, neither of us were around.
No, which is, you know, it's one of us, you'd think one of us would have seen it, but
because
no.
Because I was in when Ben won a medal in the 100, and I was in Atlanta 25 years ago when Donovan Bailey did the back-to-back Saturday nights with his group in the 4x1 and won the 100, and I've seen a lot of different, you know, Canadians run the 100, you know, over the years, virtually everyone who's been prominent in any kind of way, and to see what Andre DeGrasse did first in the 100, but today was just mind-boggling.
Let's bring in Tony Sharp, Canadian Olympian, Andre DeGrasse's first coach. Tony, welcome. And as we bring you in, your reaction, your feelings, your emotion when DeGrasse wins the gold today.
Well, you know, definitely excitement, you know, joy, very proud, but somewhat expected based on what we saw in semifinals. I didn't see Andre bringing home anything except the goal today.
So how did he go from the guy that you saw on a field, if I have my story correct, to becoming what you saw today?
Andre has a lot of God-gifted talent, unlike anything I've ever seen. His progression in terms of the sport is unprecedented in terms of time frame. So, you know, we kind of looked at the high schooler running 10.9 seconds without any formal training. That's impressive. And the progress that he made by 2015, winning the NCAAs, double gold at Pan Am, that was also unprecedented in terms of progression.
So take us back to that day on that field where you see this kid who doesn't have cleats. How did you...
He was running in cleats. It was just borrowed.
Oh, they were borrowed cleats. Okay. So yeah. So where does coming from that day to getting involved with your program and obviously going on then to college and learning and everything else, give us the progression here.
So, you know, I met Andre, I guess it was late 2012 at York University at a high school meet. And, you know, he joined us shortly thereafter. Like within a week, he was a part of our club and started to teach him a thing or two. And by the middle of the summer, by July, he was beating every high school sprinter in Ontario and, you know, moved on to college, where junior college, actually, in Kansas, where he'd ended up winning the... junior college national championship that year, and then 2 years later goes on to win the NCAA championship. So, you know, we knew we had something special way back, right? He ran 9.9 in junior college when needed, which a lot of people don't talk about. So, you know, when you see that sort of progression and it gets into the right hands, magical things can happen, and that's what we're seeing now.
Tony, take us through the fine-tuning from the last Olympics to these Olympics. I mean, not everybody does that, so what had to be worked on?
Well, if you really think about it, Andre missed 2 years of competitive track and field due to injuries, right? World Championships, was that 2017, and then 2018, he had another hamstring injury. So, you know, health has been a factor. I think the extra time played into his hands, too, in terms of gaining that confidence back that he wasn't going to fall apart in the middle of a race or get hurt again. So, you know, he's accomplished quite a bit based on a 2 year competitive cycle since Rio.
So, when you look at sprinters, and I've been seeing them for an awfully long time, Tony, there tends to be a size, there tends to be a width, a length. A look, so to speak, of what sprinters tend to look like. Andre looks like he's somebody's little cousin that they brought along to the track.
It's hard to define what a typical sprinter should look like. They come in all shapes and sizes, right? At the end of the day, it's, you know, you have fast cars, a lot of horsepower that are a little heavier than the smaller sports car. So I'd describe him as a sports car with a lot of torque and a lot of horsepower, right? You know, he applies a significant amount of force to the track, and he's able to cover distance equivalent to that of a big guy. That might not apply the ratio of weight power to his weight, right?
I know you've gone down this road, but what makes, like, what is unique about him, and like, what is comparable to other people? Is he totally unique?
For me, it's just the ability. Close. I mean, the top end, like, maintain the speed, maintenance speed, I've never seen anything like it. Like, it's really about accelerating the least to win the race. So while he can maintain his speed, the other guys are decelerating a lot faster. So that's why it appears as though he's speeding up, but they're actually slowing down faster than Andre. So, yeah, that's the uniqueness about Andre.
Is that why the 200 works better for him than the 100? And if that's
absolutely
the case... could you see him ever doing a 400?
That's a whole different animal now. Get away from that's a different. That's a little much to ask. But no, he doesn't really ever need to consider the 400. I think he just needs to fix up the first phase of the 100, and he'll also bring a gold medal in the 100.
Because we've never had a 200. I mean, you have to go back to Percy Williams. We've never had a 200 sprinter of any, you know, sort of quality, so to speak, over the years. We had guys who could make finals, but never anywhere near the podium.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the sprinters gravitate towards the glory event, 100 meters, right? Even if they're good at the two, they're still like the fastest man in the world thing. So that's one of the challenges that you run into with sprinters. They tend to want to all be the 100-meter guy because that's where all the glory and recognition comes from, right?
Tony, thanks very much for stopping by. Enjoy the victory.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Tony Sharp, Canadian Olympian, Andre DeGrasse's first coach, with some interesting insight there, I think.
Yeah, it's again, we've talked about the process. Where does a guy start and how does he start? And someone sees him in a high school meet and he's borrowed his shoes that he's wearing that day. And it's like, you know.
Hey, look at him.
Yeah, basically, that's what it is. And you know what? If a coach doesn't get interested and if a coach doesn't invest his time in him at that stage of his life and at that stage of, I hate the word career for a young man, but it became a career. And if someone doesn't make that move, who knows what, if we ever hear of, I mean, when you talk to Andre, he was really interested in basketball and he was really interested in being a high school basketball player of some caliber. And that was sort of where his mind was until he realized that he had this gift. And you know, again, it's remarkable to me that someone sees it, someone has enough to bring him to the club. His mother was, yeah, this is perfect for him. We're going to get him busy, you know, in track and field. And how many kids become that? Lots get in there. How many become number one in the world?
Well, I think it's still, you know, it harkens back to the infrastructure and how it may be inadequate in spots on certain Olympic sports that you'd like to see upgraded.
Well, thankfully, there are the Tony Sharps. And there are people like him that have been around the track. I mean, here's a guy who was an Olympic caliber runner himself, and so he wants to give back now, and he wants to be involved in the next whomever. And when a day like today hits, and he wouldn't say it as proudly as we're going to say it, but when a day like today hits, that guy's heart, and I mean Tony Sharp's heart, is beating a million miles a minute because he knows what bigger role he played in this happening.
Just makes everybody feel good.
Yeah, and that's what's so great about a story like this.
It
has so many elements to it, from the coach who had him at USC when he ran there, or the coach that had him at a community college before he got to USC, or the pro coaches he uses now, or the people that he went to in Arizona that were part of that, you know, Stuart McMillan and that group. There's a lot of people who have played a role in getting Andre DeGrasse from first meeting Tony Sharp through to the various levels it takes to win the gold medal today.
Yeah, so some great Canadian moments at the Olympics, and we're all proud of that, that's for sure.
Yeah, we haven't won a great deal of medals, but the medals that they've won have just seemed to be in spectacular fashion. And so, you know, I'm an Olympic person. I mean, I've gone to 17 of them. It's in my blood now professionally, and this is my first one I'm not at in 29 years, and so it feels kind of weird.
I was going to say, so what does that feel like for you to watch?
It feels like I'm watching a lot of television and flipping channels and, you know, watching my friends like on TV. Yeah. You know, Andy Petrillo, who we've both worked with, is doing a terrific job hosting for CBC, and so it's interesting, but the minute that the event, and I was at a golf course this morning watching DeGrasse run, I want to run right to my typewriter. And I want to start, you know, it's not a typewriter, it's a computer, obviously, but I want to start, you know, putting a story together. And that's just naturally in you from having, you know, seen, you know, Donovan Bailey do it, or Katrina LeMay Doan, or Marnie McBean, or whoever it happened to be Olympic-wise in this country, you know. when you've written those gold medal stories, they're always spectacular.
Well, that's a great thing you said there, because I think that when you're watching DeGrasse run around with the flag on his back, you're remembering all those who had done it previously as well.
Well, the weird thing of these Olympics, you're running around in a stands with nobody there.
Here we are.
And you know what? At the last three Olympics, Usain Bolt, of course, dominated the 100 and the 200. And the scene in the stadiums, because track and field outdraws everything at the games.
Yeah, it's marquee stuff.
The scene in the stadiums when he took that Jamaican flag and did his victory lap and you know, played with everybody and entertained them was phenomenal. And I feel for all the athletes right now who have been in Tokyo that they don't get that same opportunity.
It's weird stuff, but that's where we are. So coming up next, Randy Ambrosi, as we say goodbye to TSN 4 and we continue on TSN 1050.